Hi, I'm Aaron Sarovsky.
And I'm Austin Shaw.
This is Between the Keyframes.
Let's do this. We're kicking off a brand new feature to this mega podcast, vidcast.
So today we're going to be talking with Sakani Solomon. We're going to cover a lot of everything that's happened behind his career, where he came from, where he's going, what he hopes to do. And we can't wait to dig in to hear what's going on between his keyframes.
All right, I have a little blurb. I'll kick it off. Sakani Solomon is an award-winning motion design lead at Cash App, and he is based in New York City. He hails from the twinned island republic of Trinidad and Tobago. His diverse skill set in design, animation, and compositing allows him to work at any stage of the production pipeline with a high level of proficiency. Sakani is also an alum of SCAD and MOMI, the Motion Media Department at SCAD. And he's also worked at Imaginary Forces, where he worked on the Emmy award-winning project, Manhattan, title sequence for Manhattan. He's worked on film titles for Black Panther, and he's also crossed into the NFT threshold, having sold some of his passion projects as artwork. And fun fact, Sakani means joy, right? Or life.
Laughter.
Well, it's laughter?
Yeah. Well, joy is close.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Welcome, Sakani.
Hi. Thank you for having me, guys.
Well, absolutely. I'm like really excited because I don't know you that well, but I hear about you all the time.
Yes. So. I mean, I've heard about Sarovsky, the studio, ever since I was in college.
That's so cool.
So, yes, pleasure meeting and getting to know you as well.
Yeah, so I have a million questions because you're like a generation possibly behind Austin and I. So I'm curious about like your experience going from school and into the professional world. And we're definitely going to show some of your work in throughout the interview because like, it's really important for people to not just hear us talk to you, but look at like some of the amazing work. But we like to talk about, you know, this bridge between getting your education and landing in the professional world and then where your career is going to go. So while it is about the work, it's really the work to get to the work.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that that is often overlooked in our process. Like a lot of times I'm asked to go speak and they just want to see like Marvel. And I'm like, yeah, but what's really important about that job was the journey to get there. Because right. Everybody's like, how do you get to work on that? And it's like, well, it starts in school.
It does.
And you start learning and you start growing and you take care of relationships. And so I tend to harp on that, but I would like to hear other people's thoughts about that. Because you've worked at some amazing places with very prolific, clients and other talent. And I'm just like really curious about your experience.
Yeah, well, I think being an international student helped a lot because that immediately puts an extra drive on you because your place in the U.S. isn't by any way guaranteed. But also, I think another thing that helped me was kind of knowing what I wanted to do from a pretty early age, like pretty much before I started SCAD. I just knew I wanted to get better at motion design and I was already doing it before I came to SCAD, which gave me a little bit of a leg up. I remember my freshman year, the second quarter, they had the MoGraph competition. It was like a 3D, I think it was for Cool Motion.
That's right.
Yeah, and I entered and I came second and I was kind of shocked. But I actually stayed in from spring break and just worked on this project the whole time while everyone else was out, you know, doing their thing. And I kind of realized, well, you know, that's how you get the leg up to try to get that advantage. If you work a little bit harder, you know, if you do the extra work, you have the opportunity to kind of, you know, get the.
That reminds me of an old like poster flyer thing I remember seeing. It was like, there's no traffic on the extra mile.
Yeah.
Right.
That is true. That's a good one.
You like that? You like that? And I remember that. I remember that competition. And I remember. Because I remember seeing your work before I actually met you, right? Because I remember being like, whoa, who's this? Like, you know, because I was in Savannah, Sakani was in the Atlanta campus, and it was like, whoa, this piece is really good. And I remember even all the students too in Savannah were like, who's this Sakani? Like, this is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was in Atlanta as well, I was like seeing the work that was coming out to Savannah, and just keep hearing about this professor. Oh, Austin Shaw, man, his classes are insane. This is the guy that you want to, you know, be learning from. And that's why I eventually came to Savannah, just because, you know, in the Atlanta campus, Austin's classes were so, I don't want to say notorious, but that's the place where you would go to get all the goods. But also I quickly realized too, in Atlanta especially, that if you only followed the curriculum, your work wasn't going to get to the place that you wanted to. You know, I think a lot of the stuff you learn in your foundational classes, it's more of a guide to kind of guide the work that you create. But you can't rely on classes to learn like the technical skills or some of those other things. You really have to jump in and make a lot of stuff. So for me, I think it really came from a passion to make my work better, but also staying in the US. I knew I had to get a job before I graduated. And it was almost like, I don't know, for me, it was almost like, damn, how many places I could work or like how many opportunities can I get while I was at SCAN? So I ended up getting 4 internships before I graduated just to ensure that I got, you know, a job. And that, you know, that was super important because I had so much experience before I even really started my career. And it gave me the opportunity to kind of fail in a less stressful environment.
Yeah. Remember that. Let me see if I could rattle off all your internships. There was LK, Law Casper.
Yes.
There was The Mill.
Mm-hmm.
There was Imaginary Forces. And I believe Gentleman Scholar or Scholar now. But that and I remember that one because I think it was like you were stepping, and you were like consciously stepping out of your comfort zone a little bit with that one, right? Because of the Scarella work.
Yeah, the Gentleman Scholar, because it was mostly 2D. And this is like their 3D was all Maya and Super Next Level. And I hadn't started using V-Ray or any. Now back then I was only using like Cinema 4D standard renderer.
Yeah.
You can also go so far, but also they want tutorials teaching you how to make stuff look next level. Or like you have to put the texture in the reflection map to make things look good. Like they had no resources teaching you how to make stuff look good, so you would see these amazing renders and you had no idea how people were achieving those looks. So a lot of stuff you kind of had to figure out on your own.
What about those, I was gonna just follow up with the internships, like what was the value of doing internships for you during college?
I think learning just how the industry works is really, I think, important. You know, learning the nuances, communicating with producers, getting feedback, knowing it's not personal, learning to adjust your work based on people's comments, learning to listen, all the little soft things, but also getting to work with people that were better than you, that you could learn software from. But also begin to understand like what types of places you want to work at. Because if you work at multiple companies, you can compare and contrast, so you're really giving yourself the best opportunity to launch your career because you could find a place that's best suited for you. And the tricky part about doing all those internships is that it made coming back to SCAD difficult because now you're like, I worked in the real world, but now I have to take this, I don't know, anthropology class. Like it made it really difficult. I took my last class online because I graduated early, and I was doing, literally, I think it was an anthropology class while working at Imaginary Forces. So I'm like working on main titles, and then I have this other class.
You're like, sorry guys, I have to go do homework.
Right.
It's funny.
Right. But it made it very difficult to
Yeah, but did you learn something in that anthropology class?
I did. I
paid off later.
Paid off, no. But I did learn some interesting things. But yeah, it was also difficult knowing how expensive my class was as well.
Okay. So what year was that? When did you graduate?
This was 2014.
Okay. I think it's so interesting. We often talk about the pace of how quickly things have evolved in our motion design industry. Like, and we joke about like FedEx and Zipdisk and all that stuff. But like That wasn't that long ago, and you're talking about like not having access to tutorials, which is something I think people take very much for granted now, is that you could literally go online, and if you have a couple of keywords or a place to start, you should be able to find a tutorial or a short class or something that takes you step by step through the process of achieving your goal or damn near close. So I'm just like, what are you guys complaining about? Everything's out there.
Right. Yeah. It's, but,
yeah.
It's almost like a gift and a curse too, because now the expectations are a little bit higher. Because back then you could just push out a really nice render and everyone would be like, oh my God, that's amazing. God. But now it's like, at least for me, it's about, okay, well, you know, what's the idea? You know, because then you could grab a couple of assets from like Megascans, you can make an amazing scene, but you know, does it tell you a message? Is there a story to it? Is there a concept? And that's the things I learned in like Austin's class. That's the stuff I learned in design school, how to think in design and, you know, how to design, how to craft a story, how to craft an idea. And those are the harder, more nuanced things that are more difficult to learn. So it's, it's a little bit more, it's challenging, but also you have way more resources to learn that stuff. So it's a, it's a fine balance.
I was really curious going from imaginary forces and perception moving into, and I don't know if that's the direct route of how you got there, but moving into tech, moving into essentially the tech industry, focusing mostly, primarily, I'm assuming on social, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But moving from doing stuff for the big screen that you know billions of people are going to see into the small screen and that big kind of pivot, like maybe there's more, it seems like there's more freedom, but also less visibility. And I'm curious how that all works for you emotionally and practically and all the things.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that move was very puzzling for a lot of people.
Talk to us about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I left Imaginary Forces in 2016 and I like late 2016 and I freelanced in a bunch of other companies.
Good.
And I was like, you know, looking at different companies, I'm trying to figure out like, you know, what do I want to do with my career?
Right.
I've been, you know, people come in, I come in, I help. Sometimes I get the chance to conceptualize, but I don't really get tons of ownership over the stuff that I do. And that's why I always found myself, that's why I found myself making so many personal projects to kind of be able to have a little bit more ownership over the stuff that I do. I ended up working at Apple in 2018. And that really kind of opened up my eyes to like a whole different life in the industry, because people work significantly less hours, make a lot more money. And the only the difference with Apple was the work was a little bit more constrained. Then I got a message from a recruiter on LinkedIn from Square for a job at Cash App, and I went in. And I was very surprised to see what they had established there, even so early on, is that they wanted the brand to be very art-forward, art-focused. Mm. And they really allowed me to be creative and to have a lot of ownership over the work that I did. And a lot of it is just kind of recognizing the opportunity here when something's rare. I couldn't name any other place that was doing that. Like I was doing, I could do Man V level work or Buck level work for a tech company and still get all the benefits. So that was a really good combination for me. So it kind of started off doing more social stuff, but now I think we're branching out. Like we just launched a campaign that's going to be on YouTube and connected TV, which, you know, was a project that I led last year. And then is a whole bunch of other initiatives, but even like when we're doing stuff in app, you know, we have between like 35 to 40 million users. That's we need to do a notification that's going out to millions of people as well.
Yeah.
Or even on social. So you still, you know, you get the eyeballs, and as, you know, being part of a company that's scaling, I think the initiative's only getting bigger and bigger. And I feel
didn't you guys just do like a clothing line or something?
Yeah. Yeah. We did a clothing line.
Right.
You know,
okay.
And Shikani worked you worked on, because I remember you did like a lot of 3D with the designs for the clothing, right?
Yeah. like we made a couple of the pieces in 3D so we could visualize them. It was such an interesting process. Like I visualized a lot of the clothes in 3D before we actually got samples. So I would see what the fabric looked like, and we would create them in 3D, and then like soon after we'd get the actual samples. So
that's amazing.
So you kind of get the prototype. You did say something. I remember talking to you a while back, and you would describe some tech as this sort of a retirement community for old motion designers.
I can't say that you're wrong. Most of the really super talented artists that I work with early in my career, so the early 2000s into, you know, like 2005, they're at Apple. They're doing great work, but they're there. Like,
right. Well, I say that because, you know, early 2010s, they were all these superstars. And then I realized I wouldn't hear from them as much. And I'm like, where everyone go?
Go.
And I went to Apple. I'm like, oh, wait, you're here?
You're all there. Here too?
They got poached.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, okay. So this is where everyone's hanging out. I mean, I get it. It's just like, way out of studio, that work-life balance, it's tough, you know, working, you know, 9, 10, 11 at night. Or like even my experience in Black Panther being title was like nuts.
Never leaving. Yeah.
20-hour days.
Yeah. Like, even at 4 a.m. coming back in the morning at 9, you know, like people sleeping over in the studio, it can get really tough. And, you know, to do that time after time with, you know, family as you get older, you really start to pay attention to where your time is going. So, you know, I get it. For me, it was just more so like, where can I find the balance of work that's just a little bit less constrained than Apple? But, you know, I could still get some of those benefits.
No, I mean, and to be clear, I mean, it sounds like Cash App is
a really awesome
blend of like,
yeah,
really cool work, boutique culture, a lot of freedom, flexibility, but some of that tech infrastructure in terms of work-life balance.
Yeah.
I remember you were telling me it was like unlimited vacation time. I don't know if you want to talk about this or not.
Yeah, no, I do. Okay. Well, it's a bit of a trick, right? Well,
I was going to ask about that as a business owner, because there's no way I would do that. Nobody would talk me into that.
Well, it's
for anybody of my employees listening, no way.
Well, actually, you'd be surprised because
People
think they could take vacation anytime they want. Sometimes you actually take less vacation than you usually will. Like, you kind of be surprised. It's a mental thing. Like, honestly, I don't think people take much more vacation than they usually would have with, you know, like the typical vacation plan. And I think a lot of tech companies realize that and they're like, oh, well, we can offer unlimited vacation, but, you know, more than likely, no one's going to take like 3 months off a year. Like, that's not, like, no one's going to do that. But it is still nice knowing you could just take days off when you need to.
Fair.
Is there like an implicit understanding that it's like, hey, you can take off whenever you want, but you still got to get your work done? Like,
yeah.
Right? Like as long as you get it done, like, your time is yours.
Right.
Is that?
Yes. Like, you have like deadlines like you did, like on a studio side, or is it a little bit more fluid?
Oh, it is definitely deadline.
And
there have been a lot of, you know, times when I had to work like late or work on weekends. Okay. But the difference is, like, say for the Cash by Cash App project, if it's a project that you're leading and you have this grand idea that you want to execute on, it's a little bit of your fault, but you're kind of working towards a vision that you helped establish. So it doesn't really feel like, oh my gosh, I have to work so late. It's more like, you know, and Jason and I worked on that project. Which is cool, you know. So, yeah, there's a little bit more attachment, but there's more accountability as well. You know, if a project doesn't go well, the buck stops with a few people. So that's why, you know, you have unlimited vacation, but you have to be mindful of if you're out for too long, what's going to reflect on the work. But that's also where good management comes in. Like, if you can manage your time and manage your projects well, people should be able to take vacation without, you know, feeling guilty. As a manager myself now, you know, when, you know, people ask for vacation, I have to take that into consideration. But I think we do a pretty good job at getting that balance.
I do have a question, because this was hard for me, the pivot, the transition. And it's something that Austin and I talked about, I think, in an episode, but that's not out yet. And that is about the transition from being solely an artist to then managing other people and other people's career, and how there's kind of two skill sets there. Like, I think it was in the context of me saying, like, when I have, like, a really senior animator that's, like, amazing, and they want to start being more of a creative director leader, but they're, like, not the best writer, or they just don't have those soft skills that make somebody, like, aware of those things, or there's ego there that makes it more about them than about, like, other people. That could be a difficult transition into leadership. And I think at that point, it's fair to, for a studio to say, or like the leadership at the company to say, like, yeah, but like, you're doing great as like an animator. I don't want you to be a leader. Like, and I think we don't talk about that as an industry, because there's this natural like progression people want to do in their career. They want to take that next step. And that next step is often becoming the leader, even if their personality and the traits at, you know, don't really match up with it. I think somebody could just ask for more money then. Like, just say, yeah, well, I'm a very senior animator and this is what I do. Like, at that point, just ask for more money. Don't necessarily ask for different responsibility. I think that's fair to say. But I'm curious about your thoughts on it, because you've obviously, like, been through the transition and are handling it very thoughtfully, it sounds like.
You know, that's a really, really, really good point. Yeah, it is a different skill set. Like, it's one thing to be able to make something you know how to make. It's another thing to try to convey to someone else the thing that there is to be made and have them make it in a certain way. But a lot of it, too, I realize is sometimes you just have to give someone a jumping off point, because there's a reason you're hiring an artist, is to get their perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's like this balance of, you know, you want to give them guidance, but allow them some flexibility to create their best work. And, you know, you kind of give them feedback to guide them on that journey. And I think, you know, being like working with a lot of good creative directors and kind of seeing how they've managed and brought out the best in people, like especially myself, like pushing people is this fine balance. You got to push them enough, but not too hard. So, yeah, it's a lot of nuanced things you kind of have to learn. But there's a greater conversation to your point about artists feeling the need to have to jump into being like a creative director and an art director. Yeah. Because so much of those skills is just communication and being able to articulate ideas. Like, I mean, that's pretty much the job, and being able to like see things from a big picture standpoint. Not everyone can do that. And it's definitely something you have to learn. But this is a great thing also about Cash, is that to advance in your career, you never have to be like an art director or director. You could be a very senior, you know, motion designer and get paid the same as a creative director.
That's my point, yeah.
Right, like we have two tracks, you know, you could take, you could do the IC track, which is an individual contributor, and then you could go to the management track. But there's no, you know, we're really pushing for them to have, you know, kind of equal pay. So, you know, it feels pressured to go that route. Like, creative direction, obviously a skill, but nothing is created without the artist.
Completely. Right.
And then, you know, artists also need guidance, because not every artist could think in a big picture way. Sometimes they get really into the weeds and they think about the technical stuff. So, you know, I think that's a more fair way of assessing, you know, people's career opportunities. And it's a matter of beginning to feel it out and see what people want to do with their careers.
It's interesting. It's like just that idea of, I mean, I constantly talk about in classroom that idea of like finding the right fit, right?
Yeah.
And whether it's like finding a job at the right fit of a studio, or if it's finding the right role. And it's, I mean, it's tough. I mean, I don't know. I guess with students, especially like when they're younger, they don't always know. And I think it's true. I remember like being an intern and seeing the like creative director and just being like, one day I want to be a creative director, right? Right. Like just because it seems like that's the hierarchy, right? That's the aspiration. It just popped in my head like something. I don't know how to work with that with students. Maybe it's just having these types of conversations.
Well, listening to people like us talk about that nuance of, like, it's okay to not go that route or to think about it before you, like, I want to be this. Because it's a whole different thing, really.
Well, I mean, like, naturally, some titles just sound grand. You're like, you know, group creative director.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, wow, he's a big shot. And to when you think about progression, that's typically in pretty much most industries how people progress in their career. So I think it's natural. But I think now, you know, people are beginning to understand that it's not the only way to do things.
Yeah, I know, like, I changed my title based on the job and my role in it. Like, there's, so if you look at our pitch deck, sometimes I'm the executive creative director with a creative lead or another creative director under me. That means, like, hey, I'll pop in, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you'll see me every once in a while. I'll make a joke. But sometimes I'm the creative director, and that means I'll be very heavily involved in your job. And sometimes I'm the director, right? And then sometimes, like, I'm actually a designer on something. And that's, those are, like, those are different mindsets when you're doing them. Austin, you talked in our freelancer episode about how when you go to a place, you sometimes are brought in as a creative director, sometimes you're brought in as a designer, sometimes you're brought in as, like, a educator, and how,
or an
we pivot based on, you know, what the needs are of that situation. So
sort of that personas, the personas of motion designer, really generalists. That makes me curious, like, how did this kind of structure at Cash App, like, who came up with this?
Yeah, who developed that?
Oh, well, I think that's something you're seeing in a lot of tech companies as well. You think about engineers, you know, like,
true,
a lot of software engineers, they just want to code. And what you're going to tell, like, of high level, super hard to find software engineers, like, we're not going to give you more money because you're not managing, you know, like, if you lose that person, they go to your competitor. There's a direct impact on revenue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, seeing that, it's smart to just pay that person more to keep them. Yeah, and in some of these companies, they just make so much money. It's like, all
right. Right, it doesn't matter. It's like, okay, just, we want to keep you here.
Yeah.
Right, you know, we don't want you to go to a competitor. And the talent pool is small. I mean, even in motion design, I think in a lot of...
Oh my God, so small.
Yeah, exactly, in a lot of tech jobs. So... Yeah, I think it's definitely worth keeping people happy if it means you can retain them. And a lot of that is just giving people options.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really interesting conversation because obviously, like, motion design department or communication department is reflecting the model for their engineers. And that makes sense. And, like, when you think about studios, like, we are reflecting either old school post houses, right? Or where you have, like, the director at the studio and they're everything. Yeah. Or agencies who have, like, basically it's much more closely, you know, like, even my studio is like a blend of both of those things where we have, like, some pillar people and then the agency model under them. And it's, like, interesting. Like, if you were going to grow it from the ground up, what would it really look like?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, merging of models. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it made sense. I mean, everything back in the day when we started, it was just like figuring out how to make things, let alone who was in charge. And it really was like the most charismatic person is the one that talked to the client, the one that could get them to bite on the direction or all those. So those are the people that kind of became the creative directors. But now there maybe is this bigger question to ask of what really should the structure be?
Yeah. And, you know, some of that has to do with ego as well. You know, people want
Yeah.
You know, see, I'm like, all right, I'm this person, I'm up here. You know, which I get people who put in the time, put in their work. But I think there's just an argument to be made that, you know, I hate this term, but when people say, like, bricklayers, people actually doing the work should be compensated, I think, fairly. Mm-hmm. Well, not even fairly, but just, like, they shouldn't feel like they have to do a job that they might not be good at just to advance their careers.
I totally agree. When they're excelling and, like, leveling up and more productive, they should be compensated more.
That's why you see there's a lot of bad managers and not good directors because, again, people made that switch and some people might have felt like they're forced to do that and that's not what they want to do.
Yeah, or it just doesn't suit them.
Right.
And so it's like very combative. It's like, whoa, doesn't need to be like this.
Yeah.
Now, how big is your team now? Have you hired anybody?
Yeah, I personally lead a team of 5.
Okay, so you're cruising. You're growing.
Yeah, but like the design org as a whole, and this is like both product and creative design, at like 60 people at this point. It's a lot. But that's like product people actually design the app. And then, you know, creative is a combination of like, you know, I'm a motion design team, so 2D, 3D animation. But then, you know, there's illustrators, there's graphic designers, there are like industrial designers. There's a whole slew of different types of professions and types of people that you work with, you know, which is also interesting, like copywriters as well.
Yeah, you gotta write it. Totally. Yeah.
Copy is so important. No, more than ever.
Yeah.
Well, like the whole like art forward
brand. I love that.
Yeah.
Like what are the conversations like around the branding direction?
Yeah. We're at this point now where, you know, we're scaling a lot. So the idea is, you know, how do we express what the brand is for someone who's just joined? Because if you've been there for a while, like myself, there's like an innate understanding because you've been doing it for a little while. Mm-hmm. But how do you express that to someone that comes in? And a lot of it too now, because the brand is so diverse, is how do you articulate what it is to someone so they could capture that? Okay. And it's definitely a challenge because we could have gone the route where it's like strict style guide, the logo is green, this X code, it could only be used in this way. And these are how things you do brand-wise. But we didn't go in that direction. We wanted to do something new that felt a little bit more contemporary, especially with what we were seeing Gen Z gravitates towards.
Feels like the early days of MTV with the Moon Man. It was like you had this thing. And I mean, I would make mixed VHS tapes. I'd watch MTV and do like.
Right. You know, it's funny that you say that because the comparison we make is MTV in the 90s. Like you...
I'm available for hire.
Boom. Well, see, this is the thing. You're conveying your brand by a feeling more so than like a specific aesthetic vibe. But it's also hard to communicate how you recreate that because people will have certain points of view. So it's an interesting challenge and an interesting way to build a brand as well. And, you know, how do you maintain that magic as you scale is something we're also trying to figure out.
Hey, thanks for listening to part one of our interview with Sakani. Check back in 2 weeks for part 2 and more from Between the Keyframes.